Hello and welcome to another episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies and helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I am co-host Michael Blaschke and today we dive into the architecture of crypto banks. 2025 has so far been monumental for stablecoins, but most banks still cannot even handle a simple USDC payment. Switzerland-based Amina Bank, though, can. Hence, today we are speaking with Miles Harrison, Chief Product Officer at Amina Bank, to dive into the secret sauce that makes crypto banking actually work. We are with Amina Bank welcoming Switzerland's fastest growing crypto bank with 6 years of bridging traditional and digital finance and with zero defaults in crypto collateralized lending over more than 5 years, with 4.5 billion assets under management and with 69% revenue growth in 2024. Welcome, Miles. Thanks for your precious time and for your knowledge. And with that, how about you briefly introduce yourself to our audience?
Thanks for the introduction, Michael, and thanks for having me on today's episode. So I'm Miles Harrison, as you said, Chief Product Officer at Amina Group, responsible for all of the products that we deliver to market. I also lead the marketing and go-to-market teams. I started my career out in traditional finance and then around 5 years ago pivoted into blockchain and the crypto space.
Excellent. So you're exactly the right person to, with us, discuss the emergence of a new type or archetype of organization that is crypto banks. And with any organization having its very unique business model and architecture, today we really want to explore the architecture of crypto banks. But before we do so, I am simply first and foremost wondering, why do we need crypto banks? So why do we need specialized crypto banks when at the same time JP Morgan and Goldman are launching crypto services themselves?
Yes, it's a very question that I tend to get asked quite frequently. When we take a look at the wider industry with regards to financial services, we know that there are specialism across the board. So there are banks that already specialize in different segments. We specialize in Web3 and crypto. And we believe that while the regulatory framework has allowed us to operate in that domain for the last few years, and as you mentioned, yes, traditional banks are now starting to enter the fray at a growing pace. We believe that there will still be a place in the market for a bank that specializes within Web3 and crypto and focuses on the needs and the demands of both crypto natives, but also traditional investors that are looking to invest in crypto assets or to benefit from products or services that maybe at some point had their origins in DeFi.
Yeah, so what I observe in the industry is that on the one hand, we have traditional banks and they move from TradFi into crypto, if you will. And on the other hand, we have these crypto native companies that were supposed to not need any bank because DeFi in the first place was meant to replace banks. So in this set, so if you will, in this dual world problem of traditional banks versus crypto native companies, where do crypto banks sit between or next to these two types of traditional banks and crypto native companies?
Sure. So I think if you look on both sides, so let's start with traditional banks. They don't necessarily have the experience of dealing with cryptocurrencies. And while we are starting to see this foray into stablecoins, there's a much broader landscape for them to explore. And we'll probably see that that will take a greater amount of time. We have already been operating in this space for 6 years in a regulated banking environment. We are fortunate as well that Switzerland, in terms of its regulatory approach and the legal frameworks, they have existed for several years now. Switzerland being one of the global frontrunners for really pushing the boundaries when it comes to distributed ledger technology within law and within financial services. So whilst we see traditional players starting to adopt stablecoins, tokenized stocks, there's a much, much broader landscape that exists and product capability that we are offering already today to clients. They do not need to wait for the future. They can access those today. When we then think about the operational functions within those banks, we're really talking here about moving from the traditional market trading hours to 24/7. We know that crypto never sleeps. We often hear that phrase used. And we have been able successfully to implement across our bank and our organization at all levels a framework and a strategy that is enabling us to support our clients to manage effectively, adequately, stringently their crypto assets alongside their traditional assets. We also need to think about people. So we have a lot of people at our organization that are experts in crypto, but we also have a lot of experts in traditional finance. And this is something that I think I often talk about is will be a big struggle for banks over the next couple of years. Where do they find talent and people within the organization that have this knowledge that they can harness to be able to bring these propositions to market for their clients? So I think that's a little bit around some of the struggles that I foresee for traditional financial institutions. Then you spoke there about crypto companies. Particularly, we've seen a flurry of potential announcements around crypto native companies applying for banking charters or banking licenses. Having a banking license is a significant undertaking. We've seen that with neobanks and the emergence of neobanks in the last decade, where we've seen a collision of technology and regulatory and legal frameworks. There are significant challenges, and it will not be an easy pathway for these crypto native companies to overnight convert themselves into banks. Of course, absolutely possible, but it is and will be a challenging path ahead. We are there to support those crypto native companies today and in the future. And on the crypto native side, as I mentioned, we have that expertise, but we also have a very good understanding of not just the banking framework in Switzerland, but globally as well.
Yeah, so what I hear there, Mais, is that both traditional banks, but also crypto native companies struggle with bridging between the two. So traditional banks have a hard time interfacing with crypto, and crypto native companies have a hard time interfacing with traditional banks, if you will. And crypto companies, though, do need traditional banking rails and compliance and security, at least some of them, and to some extent, yeah. And this is where crypto banks, and with that Amina, exist within a sweet spot in that they can bridge both of these worlds. And Amina Bank already has an experience of 6 years of doing so.
Yeah, and one thing I would add as well there, Michael, is around within, when we think about banks or traditional financial institutions supporting crypto, it's not necessarily a case that crypto is just an extra product on their shelf, right? That product, that crypto sits alongside, you know, traditional bank accounts or securities or investment products. Within crypto and Web3, it's an entire domain within itself. And if we think maybe on the corporate side, we have different types of corporates that exist within the Web3 ecosystem. Be that mining companies, be that software providers, you know, blockchain development providers, be that treasury management services, be that foundations, stablecoin issuers, all of these entities that exist within the Web3 ecosystem have differing needs. And it's no different when we think to how a corporate bank traditionally was structured to set up to support technology businesses or agriculture. The same exists within Web3. I think sometimes we look at it at a simplistic or too simplistic level, that it's around just adding the ability to transfer in a stablecoin or to buy Bitcoin. And it's much more than that. And that's where, for us as a bank, we've been able to really make our mark in the industry and support our clients, whether they are TradFi or whether they are crypto native.
I think with that, we gave a nice intuition for what crypto banks are, why they are needed, and predominantly that they represent a new class of companies that fill the gap or bridge between exactly these two worlds. And I like your push that there is way more specificity and nuance about this bridge than just giving some crypto exposure to banks or giving some bank accounts to crypto companies. Yeah, so there is way more underneath the surface when it comes to bridging these two worlds.
And as a financial institution, I touched upon the crypto companies and the Web3 foray into banking charters. A core principle of us as a banking institution is to really understand who our clients are, who we're working with, what their activity is, and for us to make sure that we can maintain our standards when it comes to compliance and the regulation that we abide by, which was, let's not forget, put in place to ensure that as a society and as a community that we remain safe and ultimately our clients' assets remain safe. And therefore, when we think also about understanding how an individual or a corporate has grown wealth or accumulated wealth in the Web3 world, this is something that can be very challenging to traditional institutions. We actually see examples on a frequent basis where we have banking institutions which approach us to do an assessment of an individual where they may have interacted with crypto in the last decade. And while the institutions are able to do that adequately on the traditional side, I touched upon the knowledge, the expertise, bringing that Web3 view in line with how we would assess the traditional side is something that we have been able to encapsulate.
Brilliant. So it's become clear that crypto banks are a fascinating new class of companies currently emerging, in your case, for 6 years by now. But then again, of course, I need to ask, why does this class of companies emerge now? So why now? Is it the perfect storm of regulatory clarity, particularly in the US? And is it the maturation of technology? Or why is it particularly at that time that crypto banks emerge? Why didn't they do so 5 years before? Or why won't they evolve just in yet another 5 years? Why now?
So I think what we've seen is that, and if we come back to the origins of why Amina exists and why we were founded to support the crypto community and to support Web3 businesses in gaining access to the same banking facilities and access to the wider financial markets that general corporates and other clients have access to ordinarily around the world. Within Switzerland, as I mentioned, around the early adoption with regards to distributed ledger technology into the legal system and framework, has also become a hub, a thriving hub for Web3 businesses and blockchain-based projects for many, many years. But there was a problem. The problem was that these projects, these businesses were struggling to get basic banking facilities, to get access to the financial markets. And that's why we were founded originally, was to provide that access. What we're seeing now is that this is not just a Switzerland or a European, but actually a global problem. And even today, even with the developments of the last few months, we still see examples where within Web3, clients are underbanked or cut out of the market. And that's why you ask about now. That's what we are still here. Our mission remains the same as from day one, is to support those clients, to help them to grow their businesses, to help individuals that have either made their wealth in crypto or are looking to diversify and maybe use crypto as an additional asset class.
So what I understand is it's the right time now to collaborate with a crypto bank, because traditional banks will, well, at least the major part, still take years to build these capabilities. And the crypto native companies struggle with getting the banking licenses themselves. So I think it will just take too long for traditional banks like JP or Goldman to be really mature as crypto banks on the one hand, and the other hand, the crypto native companies will struggle or take quite some time with their banking licenses. So now, if you now need a bank with the capability to interface into the blockchain or the on-chain world, right now, a crypto native bank would just be the best way to go.
I would just add to that and say that from the breadth of our product offering and the problems that we can solve for our clients, that's where we position ourselves in the market. I think fast forward, we see ourselves as complementary to the traditional institutions that are coming in now, to the Web3 players that are obtaining bank charters. I think everyone has their part to play in the market. And like I mentioned, you know, having a bank that specializes within a specific sector or domain, we've seen many examples in financial services for many years now, you know, whether it's a focus on tech companies, whether it's a focus on small businesses versus, you know, large corporates. So we don't see that it's an us versus them. We see that this is positive for the market as a whole. And we see ourselves as ultimately complementary to give our clients and the wider consumers choice. That surely has to be better for everyone.
Yes, and this complementarity manifests itself in the fact that crypto simply, or crypto's 24/7 markets require different operational models that traditional markets can't yet fulfill. And also that I would assume the market just demands API-driven programmable money that creates new possibilities. And these are two of many complements you already provide next to traditional banks and crypto native companies. Yeah.
Absolutely. And there's a really good example, a recent example from our product development where this touches and on this point and really exemplifies it. Actually, we've recently launched an off-exchange custody product, which allows our clients to safely store their collateral with us as a regulated Swiss bank and trade on crypto exchanges. So it significantly reduces the counterparty risk for our clients, still gives them that freedom and the capabilities that the exchanges provide on the trading side. But when we were going through and looking at from a discovery perspective, working out what we wanted the proposition to look like, we came across the different types of collateral that our clients would like to use. And when we look at the traditional side and we think about margin call scenarios, certain instruments can only be exited during traditional trading hours. Now, if you put crypto itself as collateral or even a stable coin, or maybe a tokenized stock or tokenized form of a security, that in some instances can be exited 24/7. And so when we're thinking about, okay, what is the impact on different departments across the bank as an organization? And what does our user experience look like? We have to factor in a very different approach to if I was designing a product at a traditional institution that was just operating around traditional markets.
Really good example. So for now, let's focus on this bridge idea. So bridging the two worlds. And I would assume exactly this bridge is one of the sweet spots or secret sources of crypto banks. And it's exactly the architecture of that bridge that is super interesting to the community in general, because bringing the on-chain and off-chain world together, or TradFi and crypto, is if not the next step in the evolution of the community. So let's now focus on this bridge and what Amina's architecture actually is in devising that bridge. And in the first step, maybe what are Amina's core architectural principles when it comes to tackling the gaps between crypto and TradFi? So when it comes to building that bridge to, yeah, bridge the gap.
So we think of ourselves as dual world native. So we have the ability, and when we think about our infrastructure and when we're building, we want to be able to speak the languages of both worlds. That's the traditional banking arena, as well as blockchain and Web3. In order for us to be able to do that, but also when we think around our competitive advantages and our commercial objectives, we have to be very modular in our approach and design. We need to be able to be flexible, adaptable, and move fast. We know that the pace of technological change in general is currently at the greatest pace we've ever seen as a human race, right? And we know that within Web3 particularly, that is even far outgrowing at the moment. When we look at rates of adoption as well, we know that that's outgrowing the rates of adoption of the internet, for example. You know, we can see many different sources that are constantly quoting that. And for us, that means that we have to be able to react very quickly. And that's not necessarily also just on focusing with regards to commercial objectives, but it might also be that there's regulatory changes, there's legal changes, there's a specific market environment that requires us to handle something in a certain way. So modular design is critically important for us, and having a composable infrastructure. We're having here to piece together bits, as I mentioned, this dual world native, we're having to piece together bits of TradFi, so things like our core banking platform and everything that comes with that, alongside our integrations with our custody providers, in integration with our in-house purpose-built cold storage facility. So bringing all of these components together is critical for us to be able to deliver and delight our clients with the experience that they expect. You touched a minute ago around APIs. I can't probably get away without using that term. For sure, APIs are critically important for us, particularly with the types of clients we support. Web3 clients being digitally native, being super savvy, and really wanting, where possible, to consume our products or services via API. And so, again, we've had to think about that very carefully. And when we come back to the modular element, we allow our clients to pick and choose. Some of our clients prefer to have certain elements of their custody stack built themselves. Some of them rely on us. For example, they might want to do custody with us, but not staking. So we have to make sure that it's really flexible and our clients are able to build a package that suits their underlying needs. We then also have to think about, we touched on the concept of 24/7, and that what that comes with from our side is making sure that we have that 24/7 operational support. We are not tied to traditional hours, and through our digital channels, be that through our online and mobile banking interfaces, or be that through our APIs, our clients can carry out that activity 24/7. Also safe in the knowledge that if they did need to get in touch with someone, that we would be there on the end of the phone to support them in any queries or support that they need.
Yeah, got it. So the principles that really guide your running and changing of that architecture are being dual world native, operating a modular design, being API first, and maintaining 24 operations. I think three of them are crystal clear. I think most of our community understand why it's important to speak the language of both worlds, why APIs and 24/7 operations are needed. Can we maybe click or double click on the fourth, that is the modular design? Can you give an example of where you recently plugged in or plugged out a module that was needed to bridge the two worlds? So what are these modules and which ones did you recently plug in or out to make the architecture happen?
Yeah, absolutely. So one example I can point to is with regards to our stablecoin rewards offering. So this is something we observed as it had existed on exchanges and across other Web3 platforms and to an extent also in DeFi. And it's something that we observed there wasn't a banking provider that was offering rewards on stablecoins. And we could continue to see the adoption, the growth in the stablecoin market. We undertook research with some of our clients and we'd identified that this is a proposition that we wanted to test in the market. Where we then started to look at our infrastructure and began to identify that we needed to build a rewards engine. This rewards engine would need to take information from blockchain, from our custody modules, but then we would need to apply those rewards into our core banking engine and then surface and show those rewards to our clients on our online and mobile interfaces or through our API connectivity. And so this is where we have decided to build a specific stablecoin rewards engine. So back to this modular approach that we can adapt in the future that is not rigid or sat within the core banking infrastructure or the custody side, that is independent. And that gives us much more flexibility in the future. It means that we can, I guess, from a product perspective and I'm a product guy at heart, we can really have some fun. And so that's the approach that we've taken. And that's, again, a really good example of kind of where we're traversing those two worlds to provide value to our clients.
Yeah, that's a good example for how the modularity of the architecture allowed you to rather quickly support a feature for yields on stablecoins.
And we were able to scale that quite quickly. You know, we launched in January with just 2 stablecoins. We're now at 4 stablecoins within the first 6 months, and we're paying out some quite handsome rewards to our clients. So that's an example of where we've been able to have a direct business impact because of that approach that we've taken from a technology perspective.
All right, so these are the architectural principles that guide your implementation of a crypto bank. But then, on the other hand, the question now in the room is, of course, well, what is that architecture? So typically, when describing architectures, we use or refer to layer models or layered stacks or layered tech stacks. Maybe you can adopt this layer approach or perspective to describe the layers you employ to build a crypto bank.
Sure. Yeah. So when we visualize, and you talk there around the concept of layers. So when we visualize this, we can broadly put our infrastructure into 3 layers. So starting with the first layer, we have our core banking capabilities and platforms and services that we utilize. That, in addition to our core banking engine, can include things like our SWIFT connectivity, so connectivity to global payments in the fiat space more traditionally. That's also regulatory reporting that we have a requirement to do, and we need to make sure that the data there is accurate, of course, and is available when required. So that sits within our core on the first layer. Then we can think about layer 2, which is really our bridge, or we call our translation layer. And really, this is the key, I would say, IP that we've really built out and honed over the last few years. And this really provides that connectivity to other modules or applications within our infrastructure, and again traversing the traditional applications versus Web3 and blockchain. And then third and final layer is really then our crypto services. So these are, whether it's connectivity to our custody providers, like key wallet infrastructure, whether that's on the HSM side or MPC, whether we're looking at a DeFi integration, you know, for example, we provide data to the Pyth network So we were one of the first banking institutions to start providing market data to the PIF network. And that's something that we can do through our infrastructure, through this, what we call the third layer, which is our crypto services. So we kind of really, when we're visualizing it, we think about core banking as a base layer. Then we have our bridge and translation. And then we have our crypto services, which really fuel and drive our ability to offer products and services, whether that's across centralized finance within Web3, if we think about the concept of CeFi, or whether that's taking concepts from DeFi and working out how we can make them available in a regulated banking environment.
Now, of course, layer two, that is your bridge or translation layer, sparks particular interest because that is the secret sauce that does connect the on-chain and off-chain worlds. Now, how far can you go in describing what happens in this layer two? So how you built it, who built it, is this really your secret sauce? How far can you go in describing what it takes here to build this bridge or translation layer?
We've built it predominantly in-house. And I mentioned, you know, again, I'll continue to touch on the theme of the expertise. We have fantastic group of people that really enable us to deliver at Amina. And it's really with the interaction and expertise from each of those individuals that has enabled us over the last 6 years to really build out this translation layer, as we call it, or the bridge, as you call it. And that also comes not just from thinking about technology or product, and we've touched on operations, but that's also compliance. So when we get a request for a crypto deposit, what checks do we need to do to make sure that we are protecting ourselves and our clients? And really then, how does that need to interact with layer three? How does that ultimately interact with layer one once that transaction gets booked on our core banking system? So we've really spent a lot of our time and focus in the last few years building out that layer two core capability. We see that as the critical component here. And in the true spirit of startups, and particularly Web3, experimentation, you know, that's really been key to finding and carving out what we want that translation layer to look like, how we want it to behave, and then how can we leverage that as a business? So not just thinking, okay, this is really cool. Okay, this is great tech, really fun to work on. But as a business, ultimately, how do we then generate activity from that is conducive towards our goals as an organization?
So Miles, expect some calls from our banking audience on how you actually do build this translation layer. I think this is, yeah, exactly the capability all the traditional banks out there, at least those with appetite to enter the crypto space, are working on and potentially struggling with. And that is the secret sauce you, of course, need to protect. This is why we cannot go further here into the details, I figure. This, to me, is the most interesting part of your free layer architecture model. And yeah, now we've talked quite some time about the principles that guide your work, the actual architecture, or at least its layers. But ultimately, the end goal of this architecture is to offer products. That's why we have you, because you're the chief product officer. And now let's link exactly this architecture with the products you offer. How does Amina think of its architecture in order to serve its different client segments and also enable different crypto products?
Yeah. So when we think about the three core segments that we support, that we have individuals, those are classified as professional investors within Switzerland. Then we have corporates, and that's everything from small startups through to larger corporations. And then we have our B2B2C segment. So that's where we support banks, fintechs, and other regulated financial institutions in providing our products and services to their clients. So let me just come back to talk about a little bit about each segment, because there are differing needs, of course, across those segments. And that really impacts how we then execute and we make our products or services available, and how our clients want to consume those products as well. So when we think about individuals typically utilize our products and services through our online and mobile channels. So that's through our online web interface or our native mobile apps for iOS and Android. We provide those individuals with flexibility and freedom to access those products relatively freely and 24/7. They also, for our premium clients, they also have access to direct experts that they can contact through our digital or telephony channels, should they wish to have that additional support. From a corporate perspective, we know that many of our corporates like to operate what I would call more in a hybrid model. So they will have access and utilize our online and mobile channels, with key employees accessing those. But many of our corporates also require access to our APIs, because they're needing to do something at scale, or they're working with many, many banks around the world. And therefore, they just cannot possibly log into all of those banking interfaces. And therefore, they need to plug into their own infrastructure. So it's really key and critical that we have a full suite of professional APIs that have strong reliability, and that we really maintain the performance and level of those APIs. We also need to make sure that we're catering within those APIs for different requirements and use cases. So whether it's that a client wants to be alerted about a particular transaction that happens, whether it's that they want to be notified of a price movement, whether they want to be notified that their LTV on their loan has shifted because of a change in market prices. So lots of different use cases that we need to encapsulate and make sure are covered in that capability. Then on the B2B2C side, we then have to think about this again completely differently, because we are very much at arm's length with the ultimate end user. And we have, again, banks and fintechs and regulated providers that have different requirements and would like a different structure or setup or a way to work with us. And that can mean that some of our clients want to provide their own UI or their own front end, or integrate with their existing user interface, and maybe just want their operational teams to have access to our sort of under the hood, as it were, to see and to manage that. Some of our clients don't have the relevant resources or expertise to build, for example, a crypto trading screen themselves. So they want to rely on our product offering and strength of what we've built out. And therefore, then we come into the world of offering different types of white label services and different degrees of, are we providing or supporting with the user experience directly? Are we a little bit hands off? And then how do we manage and maintain that relationship? Ultimately, giving the end consumer complete confidence, trust, security when they're interacting, whether it's buying or selling, whether it's our custody offering, staking, or crypto collateralized lending.
All right, so B2C, B2B, and B2B2C. What kind of team does it need to serve so many customer groups? So in particular, in the CPO and CTO organizations, if you will, do you work with multiple Scrum teams? Do you have a dedicated architect? How do you maintain all the tech stack across these layers to serve so different customer groups?
So we are in a formation of agile squads, so very, very typical agile squad model. We have product dedicated squads that are focused on product verticals. Those are our core verticals across banking, trading, lending, investments, custody, and staking. Then we have additional squads, which are focused on architectural services. I mentioned the sort of stablecoin rewards module earlier on, things like pricing engines, and then sort of even more core infrastructure and IT sort of operations in a traditional world. We then have to think about, within those product squads, we have to think about the needs and the desires of each of those different segments. And how we do that effectively as well is we work with our teams in our client-facing departments. So whether that's sales or business development, we work closely with each of those where we have a good understanding of each of those segments. So whether that's one of our specialist sales team and client relationship managers who are working directly with individuals, or perhaps they're working with Web3 foundations. And therefore, we're really able to tap in and to get that feedback. This is one of the many mechanisms we use as a product team when we're going through our discovery and delivery processes within the bank.
All right. So yeah, that nicely outlines how this architecture enables products across the set or classes of customers, B2C, B2B, B2B2C. But now ultimately, let's take the ultimate look on what actual products are enabled by this architecture. So I would assume there are many. Probably you can describe just the most consumed across these different, these three different customer types.
Sure. Yeah. So let's take a look at crypto collateralized lending. So this is something that we have seen significant growth in the past 24 months. And we can think about this is akin to traditional Lombard lending. So where a client will put up collateral for the purpose of then reinvesting those borrowed funds into to other activities. That could be reinvesting, or that could be a particular project, you know, be it a real estate or whatever their objective is. In order for us to offer crypto collateralized lending, there are a few different key elements that we bring together to ensure that we can offer this to clients. That means that we can meet their needs, but also means that we can manage our risk as a bank, and that we can make sure that we stay within and comply with our regulatory and legal obligations. We allow our clients to, as part of this offering, put up, as well as BTC, you know, certain other altcoins. We also allow portions of those, if it's a relevant proof of stake protocol, we allow for those assets to be staked, so clients can be earning rewards on that collateral. As you can imagine, the crypto markets move very, very quickly, and as we've discussed, you know, constantly, 24/7 throughout the entire year, and therefore it's very important that we adequately manage those positions, and that we can also take action should we need to on those positions, both on our side, but also on our client's side, and that the client at all times has the relevant information in front of them to be able to make key decisions, whether that's exiting a position, whether that's topping up a collateral account, managing, you know, across their other accounts with other providers, and maybe across also any wallets or infrastructure they have held in DeFi. So from this product and from the underlying infrastructure, we're then able to lend out to our clients in fiat, and they're able to then use that for those fiat funds to, as I said, achieve whatever they're seeking to with their objective, whether that's reinvesting into crypto, whether that's diversifying from crypto into traditional securities, or whether that's working on something specific outside of that.
Okay, so to me, I would assume that given you target the enterprise or the institutional grade space of customers, compliancy is vital. And so one essential design criterion or feature is compliancy. So I think you refer to it as compliancy or compliant by design. But what does it actually mean that your architecture is compliant by design? Can you give some examples of how this architecture you just described and how it serves different customer classes and how it enables different products, how this architecture is compliant by design?
Yeah, so early in our discovery process, we bring on board and think about a number of different factors, internal and external. Whenever we're designing or looking to bring a new proposition or product to market, and a key component for us within that is thinking about the regulation that we need to abide by. For us, sometimes as well, it can be challenging because perhaps in certain product areas, the regulation is not as mature, not as evolved as it is in traditional finance, or even across within the Web3 domain itself. There are differing levels of maturity in terms of recognition and, you know, regulatory frameworks. And we've seen that unfold, you know, in the last 12 months with MiCA coming into effect. And there are still some parts and elements of products or Web3 concepts, if we want to call them that, that are still sitting outside of that framework. And those are in a little bit of a, you know, continued gray area. Where we have a strength is that we talked about that we've been operating for 6 years. You know, we obtained our banking license with FINMA in Switzerland in 2019. But from the outset as an organization, we have been very clear in the Web3 space that we want to help the industry evolve and mature and operate in a way that traditional financial institutions have operated for many, many decades. So quite quickly, out of Switzerland, we established a hub in Abu Dhabi, which has a friendly approach from a regulatory standpoint to digital assets and is doing some fantastic things in the region. And we also established an entity in Hong Kong. And again, the SFC, as well as the HKMA in Hong Kong, have been looking consistently over the last couple of years on how they can support the industry and how they can make sure that the guardrails and the safety and the security and the transparency is there, but in the spirit of enabling innovation and enabling us ultimately to bring products to market for our clients that provide for them and meet their needs. So that's organizationally how we've approached and made sure that we are working with key regulators that are really advancing and driving forward Web3 itself. And then when we think about the products and underlying infrastructure, it's really about making sure that we factor that in and we are when we're designing, whether it's our product designers, so our UX, UI designers, whether it's our architecture team that are thinking about how do we really position something within our existing architecture, making sure that throughout that entire process, we have at the forefront of our mind, our obligations with regulators and the frameworks that we're operating within and the high standards and bar that we set for ourselves to make sure that we can continue to maintain what we have built over the last 6 years. So really, in a nutshell, it's really just making sure that it's a consistent thought in our mind as we undertake and go through the process. If we're unsure, we have active open dialogue with our regulators to sense check, to get an understanding. And we also see ourselves as in a very good position to support, like I mentioned earlier on, those Web3 companies that are looking to acquire to obtain and go through the approval process and get those licenses, whether it's an electronic money institution license on the payment side, whether it's a banking charter or a banking license, we're in a great position to support the community in that as we move forward. So that covers kind of like the multi-jurisdictional side. And then, as I mentioned already, you know, underpinning that, and particularly when we think about to bring it back to an example like crypto collateralized lending, what we're really looking at there is how do we manage within our liquidity ratio framework? How do we make sure that we have reporting that's feeding the relevant teams? So our colleagues in credit risk, whether that's finance, whether that's compliance, making sure that they have the information available at the time that they need it to make key critical decisions. And really the challenge for myself and our CTO and the rest of the technology organization is, of course, how can we then do that in a way that is scalable and for us, again, repeatable across different segments. You know, we touched on again B2C, B2B, and B2B2C. How can we do that without necessarily kind of taking something and rebuilding it again from scratch? That's the challenge that we face, you know, on a daily.
Okay, so this compliancy by design really describes that your architecture is designed to handle different regulatory requirements simultaneously, even as you target new markets. So it's not that any particular regulation is baked into the architecture, but it's really a set of regulations can be respected. And there is kind of a logic on the functional level that understands what jurisdiction am I targeting, in which jurisdiction am I operating. And then in the next step, let's say, dynamically adjusts to this jurisdiction. Is that the intuition?
Absolutely.
Well, that's a cool feature. Yeah, I mean, but that also drives complexity. I mean, serving compliancy by design in an evolving regulatory landscape with regulators, yeah, exhibiting different levels of maturity and still maturing. That's a beautiful piece of technology, actually, that allows you to be regulatory compliant in multiple jurisdictions simultaneously.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think it would be super precious now to understand or to walk through a real example, because that best describes and lets all of us understand how the implementation and action actually works. So if you don't mind, can we walk through a real example? Let's say for a corporate client wanting to pay suppliers using USDC, what does an end-to-end flow through this very architecture look like? So potentially the three-layer architecture we just talked about. I think such an example would give some additional meat on the bone and give an intuition what actually happens for this example I just gave.
Yeah, sure. So let's start from, so if we're using the example that you touched upon, so we're using corporate client would like to pay a supplier in USDC. So for us, what does that look like in practice? So our client, whether they're already holding USDC with us, if not, they would transfer in. So they would go through our PKCP process to whitelist the wallet that it's coming from externally. That could be from a supported crypto venue. So we support a number of crypto venues that those coins can come from, or whether that's a self-hosted wallet. And we would then undertake the relevant due diligence on that wallet. We would want to ensure that that corporation has control of that wallet, that it is their wallet, and understand if those USDC coins have been sitting in there, where had those come from? So were they, you know, the proceeds of something, another transaction? Are they sort of operating funds for the corporate? What is the rationale behind those funds being in that account? If the client doesn't have USDC, but they need to pay a supplier in USDC, they would then come on to our exchange feature and purchase USDC against any number of fiat currencies, or another stable or crypto if that's what they wanted to do based on their existing holdings. So once they have the USDC sitting in their Amina wallet, and this is backed by our hot storage solution. So when we're coming back to thinking about the different layers, layer one, layer two, layer three. So right now, client has USDC that is sitting in their Amina wallet. But the next step then is that they would log on to our online or mobile interface or instruct through our API that they wish to transfer to a supplier. And from there, they would then transfer out to a wallet that was in the name of the corporation and then disperse that to the end supplier. We are currently working with, and something I can reveal, maybe a bit of an exclusive. We are working with Nota Bene at the moment on how we can significantly improve and add additional capabilities with regards to when it comes to cross-border payments and transactions, particularly between approved crypto venues. So for anyone not aware, Nota Bene are doing some fantastic stuff with regards to travel rule compliance and making it, you know, ultimately more safer and secure for users to transfer coins between different wallets where those are potentially, you know, exposed to external factors. So we will be integrating with Nota Bene in the next couple of months, and that will make the process even simpler for our clients. But, and the key that we touched on compliance by design, but without compromising that safety, security, and transparency that our clients expect from us. So that's a bit of a summary about how a corporate client would make a USDC payment out to a supplier, and then, you know, a little bit about what we're doing to improve that. And just one company I'd love to call out on this side as well, when we're talking about cross-border payments and transfers of stable coins is Mesh. I think Mesh are doing some fantastic things. You know, I first came across Mesh last year and was pitched to me that they are the Plaid of the crypto world. And it's fantastic to see what they're doing. And I think that could really help continue to drive the pace of adoption that we're seeing with crypto and stable coins in general.
Yeah, thanks for that step-by-step process. I in particular like that step in which you convert the bank instruction to a blockchain transaction, because this again exemplifies your bridging function or capability in the industry, and that justifies the emergence of a new type of bank, that is a crypto bank like Amina, because this is where the translation happens. And in doing this translation, also key technical challenges are mediated, if not resolved, like gas optimization, making a transaction or ensuring a transaction is final, the handling of potential errors, and the satisfaction of legal requirements in multiple jurisdictions for any given transaction, like the one we talked about, that is a corporate client wanting to pay suppliers using USDC. So yeah, I love this bridge translation, and I love how the bank helps to solve these technical challenges that come along with exactly this bridging.
And I think on that point, as well, you know, we've touched on as well that some of our clients are coming more from the TradFi space, and they might not have experience in making transactions between crypto wallets. Yeah, and some of the, we know as a crypto community and a Web3 community, that a barrier to wider adoption in the past has been the experience and the user interfaces and the complexity that sometimes comes with that. And when we also think about erroneous transactions or transactions going to wrong wallets or mistakes that users can make, we really try to make sure that our interface and the experience that our clients have is as simple as possible to make sure that we reduce and mitigate the room for errors. And we make sure that our clients don't necessarily need that experience or knowledge to safely and securely execute a transaction, for example, to a supplier.
Excellent, Miles. So respecting both your and my schedule with the full hour approaching and potentially next calls coming up, I love to see how crypto banks in general are nicely competitively positioned in that versus traditional banks. Amina has a 6-year head start with Bill, and it has built crypto native from day one. Then again, versus crypto companies, as Amina has proven its banking operations and established regulatory relationships. And then in particular, this bridge position that I was such a fan of with zero defaults over the last 5+ years. I'm really looking forward to where the banks develop or in what direction the bank develops into. My key takeaways for today is that first, crypto banks exist because they solve a unique bridge platform that neither traditional banks nor crypto native companies can solve alone. Yet I do understand your push that you're not seeking really to start a war here, if you will, but to be a complementary player. My second key takeaway is that the secret is in the architecture of the crypto bank. And Amina is building infrastructure that is really native to both worlds, as I understood it. And my third key takeaway is that your 6-year head start and the proven track record positions Amina Bank nicely for the institutional adoption wave that is certainly coming up. I mean, the decision runs through the decision bodies and the companies are still running and it just takes time. But once decisions are being made, I think Amina as a crypto bank is in a nice position to take full advantage of the institutional adoption wave.
Absolutely. We're super excited to see what the future brings, and we continue on our mission to empower people to navigate the future of finance.
Bravo. With that, let me end our conversation with some calls to action. First, from Amina's point of view, that is, do connect with Amina for partnership opportunities and follow Amina's super interesting thought leadership on the evolution of crypto banking that served well for me in preparing this episode. But then also from our podcast perspective, thanks for listening to BFRR today. Thank you, Miles, for your takes, insights. Do connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and our expert community on Telegram, both in German and English. And by the way, Miles, it would be lovely to see you in this community. So if you do want to share some more of your secret sauce, join our community and some questions will arise, no doubt. Then also, please do visit our website for more detailed analysis and detailed show notes, and make sure to subscribe to BFRR wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next week when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, this is BFRR, bringing Europe's perspective on digital currencies to the world. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.